You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Do you owe your love of spicy food to having had a mother who cooked with curry and cumin while she was pregnant with you? That may not be as far-fetched as it sounds. As Annie Murphy-Paul explains in her new book, Origins, researchers in the burgeoning field of fetal origins have discovered that our tastes and our temperaments, as well as our propensity to develop heart disease, diabetes, and obesity, may depend as much on our intrauterine experience as on the genes we've inherited and how we've been nurtured. Her book is published by the Free Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Annie Murphy-Paul back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Pleased to be here.
Our listeners also may have seen the cover story that you wrote about fetal origins for the current issue of Time magazine. Mm-hmm. You've said that research on pregnancy is no longer a scientific backwater. When did fetal origins become such a hot area of scientific research?
Well, about 20 years ago, a British physician named David Barker noticed something odd on a map. He noticed that it was in the poorest areas of Wales and England. Those areas had the highest rates of heart disease. And this was surprising when we think about heart disease as being associated with sedentary lifestyles and rich food. So it was puzzling to Dr. Barker why this would be the case, and he.
Well, couldn't it have been a genetic reason? A lot of people there with intermarriage having certain genetic predispositions.
I suppose, but Dr. Barker looked in another direction. He found a very strong connection between the birth weights of the people in this area of the world. And their rates of heart disease many years later, decades later. And he formulated a theory, which came to be known as the Barker hypothesis, that these individuals had been undernourished in the womb and had sort of made the best of a bad job. They had diverted what nutrients they got as fetuses to the most important organ for survival, the brain, stinting on the heart. And that allowed those individuals to survive and to be born and to grow, in most cases, to adulthood. But then they paid the price for that later in higher rates of heart disease.
Well, this is not just a situation that we find in Wales, but we find it all throughout the world. So has that held true in sub-Saharan Africa, in the poorer parts of Asia, Latin America, the United States?
It has. It's been replicated many times now in many different populations all over the world. And in fact, it's a major cause of the epidemics of heart disease and obesity that we're seeing in developing countries, because those are the places where the transitions are happening especially fast from a subsistence diet to a Western-style diet, so that a fetus may be undernourished in the womb, but then grow up in a culture and a world of excessive calories. So in that case, their bodies have been prepared for one kind of nutritional reality, and then when they're born, they encounter quite a different one, and that creates health problems for them.
So we're likely to see obesity where there was low birth weight. What about premature babies? Does it apply to them as well?
No. Dr. Barker wasn't looking so much at babies who are low birth weight because they are premature. That's kind of a different thing. He was looking at babies who are born at term but underweight, you know, 5 pounds or less, because they receive substandard nutrition in the womb.
Now, many traditional cultures have over the years argued that a woman, what she experiences when she's pregnant will have an effect on the baby. But are we talking about the same sort of thing?
Mm. Well, that's one of the most interesting things to come up in the research for my book, Origins, that I wanted to give some historical context to this idea that we're shaped by ideas and experiences in the womb, experiences and events while we're still in the womb. Because this is an ancient idea. It's found in most cultures and at most times in most places in the world. And it's actually the mid-20th century a Western scientific and medical establishment that was really the anomaly in this way, that where many doctors and scientists of this period believe that the fetus was not impressionable, was sealed away in the placenta, but was sealed away in the womb. And these kinds of beliefs actually led to some major medical tragedies like thalidomide and DES, where pregnant women were given drugs while they were pregnant, with the idea that anything they took would not affect the fetus.
They also weren't discouraged from drinking. Have a couple of glasses of wine because it'll calm you down.
That's right. Fetal alcohol syndrome, which is so the concept is so familiar to us now, was only coined in the that diagnosis was only coined in the early 70s, and before that, it wasn't believed that alcohol could have a damaging effect on the fetus. And in fact, as you say, some women were encouraged to drink by their doctors to relax them.
And this is because they believed that the fetus was protected and isolated from the world by the mother's placenta during pregnancy?
Right. There was not a complete understanding. Our understanding is still not complete, but we have a much greater sense now of the permeability of the placenta and the vulnerability of the fetus to toxins, including alcohol, but also including environmental pollutants. In fact, the fetus is the most vulnerable, is at the most vulnerable stage in terms of exposure to toxins because of its small size and because of its immature state of development.
But didn't the medical community also regard the fetus as the perfect parasite, which is able to take what it needed from its mother's body even if she didn't or wasn't able to care for herself during her pregnancy?
Exactly. That was part of the same attitude, that the fetus would be fine no matter what the pregnant woman did.
And isn't that sometimes the case?
Well, the fetus can adapt and can survive, for sure, even given very harsh conditions. But that doesn't mean that there won't be consequences later on in that individual's life. That's what Fetal Origins is demonstrating.
We've all read stories about women who didn't know they were pregnant giving birth to healthy babies. Are those children anomalies?
I'm always stunned by those stories. I can't.
Me too, because every woman I know who's been pregnant has told me that they knew very, very soon.
Yes, yes. Well, certainly you'd think by the time you were ready to have a baby, you would know. But human females are built to bear babies, and there certainly have been very harsh conditions in our ancestral past. But that's part of what's most interesting about this emerging field of fetal origins, that the theory is that the fetus actually is adapting to and preparing for the particular world that it will inhabit on the other side of the womb. So if it prepares for one kind of environment, one that is very scarce in food, for example, or one that's full of dangers and hazards and stress, and then finds another kind of environment, it actually prevails once they're born. That mismatch is what causes a problem.
My guest is Annie Murphy-Paul, whose latest book is called Origins, How the 9 Months Before Birth Shaped the Rest of Our Lives. It's published by Free Press. Well, the popular culture has believed this, that there was some kind of influence, and we were told not all that long ago that if we played Mozart for somebody was pregnant, or language tapes, that the baby would become smarter or have a love of music or be able to speak foreign languages. That's been debunked.
Yes, it has. And in the popular imagination, I think that is the idea of what prenatal influences are. But we're not talking about, you know, putting a pair of headphones to a pregnant belly and playing Mozart. That's not likely to do anything for the fetus and may even be harmful. But we're talking about a process that's much more visceral and consequential. It's about molding and shaping the fetus over the course of 9 months, through cues that the fetus gathers from the mother and through the mother, the environment that the mother lives in.
Well, is this just a nutritional thing? Don't recent studies show that there are in utero messages to the fetus about whether the world that he or she will be entering will be one of abundance and security or one of deprivation and stress?
Right. Nutrition is one of the major sources of information, you might say. In the book, I call them biological postcards from the outside world. These are clues and hints that the fetus is gathering, and nutrition is one of the major sources of information. The other major one would be stress. And if you think about it, those are the two things that anyone entering a new world would want to know. Is there enough to eat, and am I going to be in danger? So, and when I talk about stress, this is something that, you know, pregnant women really worry about. They worry about what they eat, and they worry about feeling stress. And so I want to emphasize that the research, the fetal origins research, has really been examining the damaging effects of life-threatening stress, of the stress experienced by women who are in a war situation, for example, or a natural disaster. The everyday stress of that a working woman with children might experience, that kind of moderate stress is actually good for the fetus. It actually accelerates fetal development, brain development. So I think, you know, any listeners out there who are pregnant, who are worried when you hear the word stress, we're not talking about everyday, ordinary stress.
Some years ago, I dated a science writer, and she had a study to cite for pretty much anything that came up. And I wonder about what happened when you became pregnant, because you've written for the New York Times Magazine, Slate, Discover, other publications on science matters. Did you suddenly start thinking about all the studies that you'd read?
Well, it was actually a quite a deliberate project, because I was...
What, getting pregnant or reading?
Well, both. I set out to write, to research and report this book while I was pregnant. And the book is structured around the 9 months of my pregnancy. And each month I examined a different prenatal influence, diet, stress, chemical exposures, moods and emotions. And each month I interviewed a different series of experts and delved into a different area of the literature. And went into the labs of fetal researchers to watch them do studies on pregnant women. And but all the while, I was pregnant myself. You know, my belly was getting bigger and bigger as this was going on. And so the two were completely intertwined, my own pregnancy and what I was learning about as in the course of researching the book.
We'll come back to some of the studies after we take a little break. My guest is Annie Murphy-Paul. Her latest book, Origins, How the 9 Months Before Birth Shaped the Rest of Our Lives, is published by Free Press. We're back with Annie Murphy-Paul, who has written about scientific matters for the New York Times, Slate, Discover, Best American Science Writing, among other publications. She was here some years back to talk about a previous book, The Cult of Personality, which was a cultural history and scientific critique of personality testing. And now she's written Origins, How the 9 Months Before Birth Shaped the Rest of Our Lives, published by Free Press. And this is based on some of the latest research. Some of the things were surprising to me. Exercise. One study showed that the fetus as well as the mother benefits from aerobic exercise during pregnancy. I always worried about miscarriage.
Right. That's some changing conventional wisdom. I mean, I think the advice to women to rest and not be too active during pregnancy, I think, was a relic of the Victorian era, when women were advised to literally confine themselves to the home. And now we know that that moderate exercise can be not only good for the woman, but good for the fetus as well.
A lot of brilliant people came out of the Victorian era's mothers, so it couldn't have been all that bad. You found another study done in Boston that found women who are pregnant with boys generally seem to consume 200 more calories a day than those pregnant with girls.
Yes, you mentioned earlier that there's a lot of folk wisdom around pregnancy and that some of the science emerging from the labs today seems to confirm that. And that's true for a number of instances in which there were sort of folk ideas about how to predict the sex of a baby. And one sort of longstanding idea was that women who are pregnant with boys eat more and are hungrier, and that it turns out to be actually true.
And do we have any idea why? Because that doesn't necessarily predict the birth weight of the child. Girls are born just as large or small as boys.
Well, actually, boys are...
They tend to be bigger?
They tend to be a few ounces bigger, but scientists didn't know why that was. And now the thinking is that the testosterone secreted by the male fetus actually affects the woman's appetite.
Was I being accurate when I said that the offspring of women who ate certain spices while they were pregnant had found to be had an effect on people's eating habits?
Yes, that was in a section of the chapter in the book about eating during pregnancy, which for many pregnant women, mealtimes turn into a minefield of all the things that they're not supposed to eat. And I wanted to present a somewhat different perspective on that and show that in choosing what to eat when pregnant, a woman is actually teaching and sharing with her fetus what it's safe to eat, what's good to eat. It's actually an evolutionarily adaptive kind of mechanism for introducing the fetus before, you know, the child before birth to one of the greatest manifestations of culture, which is food.
So what does our tendency to eat a lot of junk food mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very good question. There are indications that the obesity epidemic begins in part with intrauterine experience. And there's a very interesting animal research, animal experiment that I talk about in the book, where the pregnant rats who were fed junk food during their pregnancies, their offspring preferred junk food and ate more of it and became fatter than the offspring of rats who ate normal rat chow during pregnancy. So they were, in a sense, learning, and perhaps the reward centers of their brains, researchers think, were being programmed by this early experience, this early exposure to sugar, fat, and salt in the womb.
You mentioned what happens when mothers are malnutrited.
And
there are a couple of studies that you looked at that followed a group of Dutch children born to women who'd suffered near starvation while they were pregnant during the Nazi siege of the Netherlands in 1944.
Yes, that's a very dramatic story because these were women in a modern Western country who were very suddenly thrown into starvation conditions by this Nazi siege, and very good records were kept of the women before and during and after their pregnancy. So scientists were able to follow their offspring and see that in middle age they had higher rates of obesity and diabetes. And we think that's because of this phenomenon you and I were talking about earlier, that fetuses who are malnourished in the womb prepare their bodies for one kind of nutritional reality. I like to think of it as the pregnant women telling the fetuses a story about the world that they're going to encounter on the other side of the womb. And when she is, in a sense, an unreliable narrator, when she tells one story and then there's a different story that prevails once the baby is born, that's when a problem happens.
Also, like the Welch children, scientists who examined this group of children years later found that its members had a greater chance of developing heart disease than the general population. But weren't doctors initially skeptical of those findings because for a long time, heart disease was thought to have been caused solely by lifestyle choices and heredity?
That's right. And David Barker, the British physician I mentioned earlier, who was really the pioneer in this area, he was a very lonely researcher for a long time. He was actually jeered at in meetings. People would walk out. People didn't take his ideas seriously at all. But he persisted, and over the last 20 years, study after study has confirmed what Barker proposed. And so the Barker hypothesis, which I think was called that in part so that people could distance themselves from it, you know, that's his idea, is now Barker is far from the only champion of that idea.
Do you have any idea how much smaller those Dutch infants were than what would have been considered normal or average?
Well, this is the interesting part. In many cases, the fetuses were not, the newborns were not necessarily much smaller than normal. That one of the strange and almost mind-bending things about fetal origins is that sometimes the consequences of what happens in the womb can only be perceived many, many years later. It's very hard to get your head around that cause and effect.
How much weight are women today generally advised to gain while they're pregnant?
Normal weight women are advised to gain 25 to 35 pounds during pregnancy. There's been some discussion in the medical world lately about whether women should be advised to gain less weight during pregnancy than those recommendations, which have been around for a long time, and specifically whether obese women should be advised to gain less weight during pregnancy or perhaps not gain any weight at all. And there are some doctors who think that obese women should actually lose weight during pregnancy.
And then there's been talk about nutritional supplements, a debate over calcium, for example.
Hmm.
Again, because we are not sure just how much calcium makes for strong bones in the baby and how much will make for serious medical problems somewhere down the line.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's very difficult to do research in this area, as you can imagine, because we obviously can't take a group of pregnant women and assign some of them to one condition and others randomly assign them to another that might be harmful for them. So that's why fetal origins researchers rely so heavily on what are known as experiments of nature, these sort of dramatic events like the Nazi siege in Holland or like earthquakes, even the 9/11 terror attacks.
I'd assume Hurricane Katrina.
Hurricane Katrina, yes, and a very devastating ice storm in Canada. These are all stories that I write about in Origins because they allow scientists to look at the effects of very extreme circumstances.
My guest is Annie Murphy-Paul, whose latest book is Origins, How the 9 Months Before Birth Shaped the Rest of Our Lives. It is published by Free Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We've gotten a number of calls and comments on our show page from listeners. I'd like to address a few of them. A caller wonders whether a mother's behavior during pregnancy impacts the baby's energy level. That is, a mother who relaxes while pregnant, will she have a more mellow child?
Hmm. Well, the research that comes to mind in relation to that question concerns women who are depressed during pregnancy. And the babies of women who are clinically depressed tend to be have somewhat lower birth weight and arrive somewhat earlier. And they may also have more irritable temperaments and more difficulty sleeping. So there does seem to be, and again, it's always hard to separate out what are genetic factors, what are postnatal factors, but there does seem to be an effect of, in this case, the intrauterine environment provided by a woman who is depressed or anxious.
Another caller said he or she had read a study that women in Germany who'd undergone stress during World War II had an unusually high number of children who later turned out to be gay. Hmm. Has sexual orientation been tied to prenatal stress?
Hmm. I'm not familiar with that study. There are a number of studies that tie severe stress, for example, during the Great Leap Forward, which was a disastrous modernization campaign in China in the mid-20th century, tied that kind of stress to higher rates of schizophrenia in young adults later on. And that was also found in individuals who were gestated during the Six-Day War, the Arab-Israeli War in 1967. So there's a variety of conditions that have been tied to severe stress during pregnancy.
And you mentioned 9/11. Did we see a change in the children who were born during that time?
Yes,
in New York?
For that story, I interviewed a psychiatrist in New York named Rachel Yehuda, who, you know, like many of us in the city, saw the towers fall on television. And she immediately wondered what the effect would be on the fetuses of women who were pregnant. And there were indeed a number of pregnant women who were in the towers or in the immediate vicinity of the World Trade Center. And she followed a group of their babies after they were born and found that the women who developed PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, their babies also showed had a biological marker that indicates a vulnerability to PTSD as well. It appeared that these women had passed down a sensitivity to stress and trauma to their offspring. And the part of that story that really interests me is again this adaptive nature of it, of what's going on here, that these women may in a sense be telling their fetuses, their children, watch out, it's a wild world out there, it's a dangerous world, telling them stories about what life is like before they're even born.
How important was the timing of the stressful event? If a stressful event had to occur during pregnancy, would it have less impact if it happened near the beginning or near the end?
In the case of the 9/11 babies, if the woman was in her third trimester when she experienced 9/11, the connection between the mother's PTSD and the child's PTSD vulnerability was especially pronounced. But there are other studies, for example, of the Northridge earthquake, which is a large earthquake that happened in California, where it was women who were in their first trimester of pregnancy when they experienced the earthquake. They delivered their babies earliest of all, and less so as the pregnancy progressed. So it's a very complicated field, and we see a variety of results like that.
On a more positive note, a study you wrote about found that women who saw a picture of their fetus during a sonogram became more attached to the fetus, and I guess an unintended benefit of using that technology. But did that have an effect on the fetus then?
That's very nice. I'm not sure. That actually was, in a sense, not an unintended benefit, because that study was from a researcher who is deliberately using ultrasound consultations as a way to increase attachment between the mother and the fetus before birth. And his theory is that this could be helpful in a number of cases. For example, when pregnant women are depressed, they may not feel any kind of connection to their fetus, which may carry over into a lack of attachment to the baby. So if they can begin building a relationship with the baby while it's still a fetus, the idea is that that will benefit both mother and child. A woman who has diabetes and gets to know her fetus, in a sense, by looking at him or her on the ultrasound screen, the idea is that she may be more conscientious about her medication routine because she's formed this attachment.
And I'm assuming that somebody who's depressed is more likely to take the therapy seriously if she's in therapy.
Yes, the problem with depression during pregnancy is not only that levels of stress hormones like cortisol may be raised during depression, but also that depressed women may not take good care of themselves. They may not pursue prenatal care. They may not stop smoking or drinking. So depression, I argue in the book, is something that we should screen for in pregnancy, just the way we screen for gestational diabetes.
Kate in Brooklyn asks, can you comment on the influence of personal care products and hair dye on the fetus? Has anybody done studies on that?
Yes. I devoted a chapter in Origins to the impact of environmental toxins on the fetus. And this is something that we're just becoming aware of, how very important this is. I mean, we learned some lessons from thalidomide and DES in the middle of the last century.
But those were powerful drugs. It's not the same thing as dyeing your hair.
Well, there's drugs. There's toxins and pollutants and chemicals in the environment all around us. And what we're learning now is that There's a class of chemicals known as endocrine disruptors, and many of your listeners will have heard of BPA, bisphenol A, which is a chemical found in plastics like Tupperware and plastic containers, water bottles. That doesn't have to be present in large amounts to do damage. It's quite the opposite. Because these chemicals mimic our body's own hormones, even a small amount of them can be problematic.
Didn't studies you looked at show that fewer boys are born during times of general stress, such as wars or famines? Do we have any idea of why more girls would be born during those difficult times than boys?
Yes, the theory is that in difficult times, it's more advantageous, evolutionarily speaking, to have a female child who will bear offspring for the grandchildren for the parents of the female.
That must have been a weird thing in China, where boys are valued in many instances more than girls, there was a very stressful time between famine and all the other things that happened in China 10 or 15 years ago. I'd imagine that it really had an impact on the number of boys and girls being born there, and we're seeing the effect today.
Well, I have a chapter in Origins about fetal sex, which is has been an object of fascination to people for millennia, guessing whether their future child will be a boy or a girl. And there's the fetal sex selection that we do on our that happens in countries like China, where people selectively abort female fetuses. And then there's a sort of natural process that goes on where male fetuses are aborted, spontaneously aborted more often than female fetuses because they are weaker.
Well, you've noted that fewer boys are being born today than were born 50 years ago. And you spoke with Deborah Davis, who was a guest on our show yesterday, about why that might be occurring.
Yes.
She was talking about cell phones. It has nothing to do with cell phones.
No, but she believes it has to do with all the chemicals that are in our environment, and many of which have not been tested for whether they're safe for the developing fetus or not.
And so these environmental factors like pollution might be causing a decrease in boys being born?
Yes, we're talking about a very, very small decrease. But as Dr. Davis said to me when I interviewed her, we're talking about the future of the species here, so we don't want to mess around with that.
I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Annie Murphy-Paul, whose latest book is called Origins, How the 9 Months Before Birth Shaped the Rest of Our Lives. It's published by Free Press.
Thank you.